to Laura's room at night and talked to her. Laura told me that she was terrified at first, but then realized the girl didn't mean her any harm, that she was sad and lost, and that she wanted Laura to be her friend. I think Laura's mum eventually heard Laura having conversations in her room, and that's when Laura told her matter-of-factly about Beatrice. Laura's parents took her to the doctor, who said it was all connected to the onset of puberty, that they shouldn't worry. But Laura's mum then took her to see a psychiatrist who, according to Laura, was pretty harsh. Laura had refused to give me all the details, but I was sure this was one of the reasons why she refused to see a therapist now. In the end, Laura pretended that she knew the ghost wasn't real, that Beatrice had stopped visiting her.
But she still believed Beatrice was real?
Yeah, and get this. She went to the local library and found out that a 12-year-old girl had died in her house 30 years before, was murdered, actually, by her dad.
My God.
I know. Laura said she was convinced for a while that her own parents were going to murder her. You've met them, haven't you?
Unfortunately.
Well, then you have at least some idea. They were horrible to her when she was a kid. Just before this whole Beatrice thing happened, they took her out of the school she loved, where all her friends went, and made her start going to this awful, strict girls' school. They made her break contact with her best friend because they thought she was common. It was all pretty traumatic for Laura. That's why I think she started to believe in Beatrice, a kind of imaginary friend, something her parents couldn't take away from her, no matter how hard they tried.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Eventually, Beatrice stopped visiting. Laura was 14 by then. I mean, this went on for a long time. And she says that Beatrice told her that she was going to the next place. And that was it. Laura's parents thought their daughter had stopped believing long before, but Laura still believes now that Beatrice was real. She still believes in ghosts.
Erin exhaled. So what? You think she's seeing Beatrice again?
I don't know. A chill ran through me as I thought about the trauma Laura had suffered recently. I think she's probably imagining a different ghost. Erin took out her phone again.
One of the drugs she was on, trazodone, apparently it can cause hallucinations.
I shook my head. Had Laura been warned about these possible side effects? Hopefully after her overdose she would stop taking them. I resolved to talk to her about it. The situation with Laura had made me temporarily forget the mystery I was grappling with, but it came back soon as I stepped into the relative warmth of my flat and saw my laptop. I poured myself a drink and was shocked to see how much my hand shook as I raised the glass to my lips. The inside of my head felt like a hive in which the bees were at war. My next session with Dr. Sauvage was scheduled for tomorrow, thank God. I am by nature a reticent person, but right now I badly needed to talk to someone. I was too wired to go to bed, so I switched the TV on and sank into the sofa with my MacBook on my lap. A horror film was starting on Channel 4, in which one of a group of teenagers go into the woods and meet a grisly end. I quickly turned it off, but it was too late. The memories were triggered. A thin pink gown wrapped around a bundle of bones. Tears sliding down a hollowed-out cheek, blood-stained fur, and two pairs of glassy eyes. I stood up and paced the room. When I was coding, working on an app, I would do this to work through problems. Moving helped me to focus, to dislodge the blockages and untangle the knots in my head. I picked up a DVD case, a rom-com, forced myself to remember the plot, the funny scenes, sunshine and beaches and kisses. Finally, the real memories were displaced, shoved back in their box, the lid slammed shut. I put the DVD back on the shelf and returned to the present moment, sitting back down with my laptop. Why had my burglar returned it? Was it possible that I had imagined the break-in, in the same way that Laura thought she was seeing ghosts? No one else had seen evidence of the burglary because I had cleaned up before my only visitors, Jake and the police, had come round. I hadn't even taken any photographs. Was it fantasy brought on by too much alcohol and too little sleep? Did I damage the door myself, then forget I'd done it? When I thought back across the past few weeks, there were holes there, black spaces in my memory, pockets of time that I couldn't account for.
I paced back across the room. No, it had to be real. Somebody else had damaged the front door. My bank account had been defrauded, and that was because my burglar had cloned my card. Unless it was me who used the cards. I shook my head. No, that was impossible. I hadn't withdrawn that cash or gone to the Apple store. Unless I was losing my mind. When I closed my eyes, I saw a flash of myself surrounded by iPads and computers and speakers. Could I really have gone to the Apple store and spent £1,600 on a new laptop without remembering? And where was that laptop? Because the one sitting here now was definitely my old one, with the exact same scratches and marks. Tomorrow, I decided, I would tell Dr. Sauvage the rest of what had happened in Romania. I had to take the memories out of their box, expose them to sunlight, get them out of my head. I had to share them with someone who wouldn't be driven crazy by them before they drove me crazy. Only then would I be able to move on with my life. Chapter 22. After an hour of thrashing about in bed, my brain whirring like a helicopter, waking dreams in which I alternately ran through a forest and wandered through the glass temple of the Apple store, I got up and opened a bottle of red wine. I craved oblivion. I set the glass of wine, full to the brim, the liquid thick and dark as blood, on my desk and sat down. I opened Spotify and put on one of my favourite albums, drowning out the ticking clock and the rumbling voices of the couple who lived upstairs, who often stayed up late into the night, alternately arguing and having noisy sex, and decided to try to catch up with some emails. Most of them were junk. I deleted these and moved the numerous messages from Skittle into a folder to deal with when I felt more alert. The last time I had sat up in the middle of the night with my laptop was when I was working on my app, Heatseeker. Skittle were confident it was going to be the next big dating app. Some acquaintances thought I had lucked out when I'd done the deal, but although there might have been some luck involved, I had worked hard to achieve my good fortune, sitting up through the night while Laura slept in the other room. I had poured hundreds, perhaps thousands of hours into creating what I thought it was my baby. I gulped down wine and carried on working through my emails, until I spotted one from Laura that had arrived earlier that day, a few hours before her suicide attempt. I thought you might want to see this, Laura X. Attached to the email was a photograph. I double-clicked on it, and the iPhoto software, which was set to automatically start when I clicked on a picture file, opened up and displayed the picture. It was a photo of a pair of kittens wrestling each other. I sat back. Why had Laura sent me a photo of kittens? That was weird. But if she'd done it just before trying to kill herself, she clearly hadn't been acting normally. I scrutinized the photo for a few moments, trying to figure out if there was some kind of secret message hidden in the picture, but it was just a pair of cats. Now that iPhoto was open, I did something I didn't normally allow myself to do, not wanting to torture myself, and began to flick through old photos. Here was the record of my and Laura's time together. When Laura and I were first together, we took photos of each other all the time. There she was, lying back on the grass in the park, sunglasses on, a huge grin lighting up her face. Here we were, with our cheeks pressed together, on our trip to Alton Towers, the camera held at arm's length. There were dozens of pictures of us just hanging around at home. As time went on, there were fewer spontaneous everyday shots, but there were still hundreds taken at parties and friends' weddings and on days out. With changing hairstyles and clothes, lines spreading on our faces, an inch or two added to our waists, I watched us grow a little older together over the 5 years of our relationship. Of course, it hadn't always been idyllic. No one photographs the bad times, the arguments, the periods of boredom, the blips when we took each other for granted or I neglected her for work. But this was our life together. The life that we hadn't been able to maintain. There were very few pictures from our European trip, because our camera had been in one of the backpacks we left behind in Breva. The only photos from the trip that remained were those I'd taken with my phone. These had been automatically synced to my computer when we got home, and my laptop and phone started talking to each other,
I had never dared look at these photos, but now I felt my finger drift across the computer's trackpad until I was looking at the first photo I'd taken, a selfie with both of us on the Eurostar to Brussels. We'd been so happy that day, setting off on our amazing journey, free from worries and responsibility. I flicked through the photos, smiling at the memories of France and Spain and Italy. I emptied my wine glass and fetched the bottle. I reached a picture of Laura in the cafe near Budapest station where we had eaten before taking the train. I had snapped a picture of her when she wasn't looking. Her face was in profile, and she was brushing a strand of hair away from her eye, pensive, pretty. I stared at the photo for a long time, taking another swallow of wine to deaden the pain. This was the last picture of her before the calamity. Or it should have been. For when I tapped the cursor key, expecting it to take me back to the first picture in the album, a new photograph of Laura appeared. As soon as I saw this new picture, I dropped my wine glass, the shattering sound distant beneath the thrumming in my ears, oblivious to the red stain that spread across the carpet by my feet. In the photo, Laura was lying on a bunk asleep, her arms wrapped around her chest, knees drawn up. The photo had been taken in the sleeper compartment of the Romanian train. And, trembling, I clicked. In the next picture, I was asleep in the other bunk, mouth ajar. I snatched my hand away from the laptop like it was on fire. The headache from earlier had returned. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see the fresh red wine stain on the carpet, the colour of dried blood. I thought back to that night. I had fallen asleep holding my phone. It had been dead when I woke up, but there had still been a few percent of battery life left when I fell asleep. The person who snuck into the carriage and stole our passports and tickets must have used my phone to take photos of us sleeping. And trembling, I clicked back to the first photo and found myself looking at the picture of Laura at Budapest station. Confused, I clicked again, back to the first photo of us on Eurostar. I went back to the album, scoured the thumbnail photos. The two pictures from our night on the train weren't there anymore. They had vanished. I thought I would never feel as scared as I had been that night in the forest, but now I started shivering. Unable to move, my mind shutting down into pure instinct mode. Aware of the shadows around me, the darkness outside. I stood up, and the room spun around me. I was drunk, so drunk, more than I had realized, so pissed that I was hallucinating photographs. Drunk and crazy, a little voice in my head said, "Oh, just fucking crazy." Something thumped above me, and a woman cried out. I clutched my chest. But it was just my neighbours, fucking noisily again. I staggered across the room, my heart skittering crazily. I picked up my phone and called Laura's mobile, hanging up after two rings when I remembered what time it was and that Laura was in hospital. She was seeing ghosts, and I was imagining phantom photographs. I started to laugh. We really were the perfect couple. Chapter 23. An elderly woman with a face that looked like it had been in the tumble dryer too long stood outside the hospital entrance in her dressing gown, attached to a drip that hung from a metal stand on wheels, smoking a cigarette down to the butt. I kept a wide berth. The smell of smoke was liable to turn my stomach after the night I'd had. I felt wretched, poisoned by alcohol and lack of sleep. But visiting hours were 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., and I needed to see Laura. Even the cloudless ice-blue sky and the wintry sunshine couldn't make me feel better. I walked through the hospital quickly. I carried a bunch of yellow and apricot tulips, her favourite. I was eager to see her, though I had decided not to tell her about my weird episode in the night. My eagerness waned as I approached her bed, which had a thin curtain drawn around it, and heard voices. The hectoring boom of her mother, Sandra, and the reedy whine of her dad, Frank. My heart sank. I had hoped I would miss them. I took a deep breath and ducked through the curtain. Both of Laura's parents turned, frowns etched on their faces. Laura was propped up in the bed, a pillow behind her back, her skin as white as the bedsheets. She stared into the middle distance, her face blank. Seeing her like that made me want to put my arms around her and somehow make it all better. An instinct that should have been even stronger in her mother.
"Daniel," said Sandra, a hint of reproach in her voice.
She air-kissed me. She had the faint scent of lavender talc. I hoped I didn't still stink of alcohol. And I nodded hello to Frank, who appeared to be dressed for a winter's day on the golf course.
"My daughter's been a very silly girl, hasn't she?" Sandra said.
She tutted and looked at Laura, like she'd been called into the headmaster's office to be told that her daughter had been caught snogging a boy behind a bike shed. I went over to Laura and leaned over to kiss her cheek, but she flinched away, refusing to meet my eye.
"I thought you'd come last night," I said, addressing Sandra. "Frank had a very important dinner meeting. We simply couldn't get out of it."
I swallowed. While Laura and I had been a couple, I had bitten my tongue in her parents' presence, practiced deep breathing exercises, and made as many excuses as I could to avoid their company. When I first met them, I could scarcely believe they were for real. Had thought Laura's stories about how they cared more about money and status than they did about her must be exaggerated. They weren't. The Mackenzies had got lucky buying a couple of cheap houses in London in the 80s before selling them on for a ridiculous profit at the peak of the property boom. Since then, they had moved to Cornwall and set up a lifestyle consultancy business, advising rich people how to maximize their work-life balance. They'd never hidden their disappointment in Laura.
"Working for a charity is all very noble," Sandra had said on that first meeting, her nose wrinkling. "But don't you think charity should start at home, Laura? That you should look after your own needs first? What do you think, Daniel?"
"I think it's great that Laura is doing something she's passionate about. There's more to life than earning loads of money." Sandra had looked at me with disgust.
"They've always been the same," Laura had once told me. "If I came home from school and told them I'd got 80% in an exam, my dad would ask me what went wrong with the other 20. Mum was always pointing out my physical flaws. If I bumped into something, it would be typical clumsy Laura, or if I had a spot on my face, she would point it out to all her awful friends. I couldn't wait to escape." A big sigh. "They're still my parents, though."
So there were the biannual trips down to Cornwall to stay at their huge, tasteless house, filled with expensive ornaments and horrible modern art. Frank was usually at the golf course, or at work, while Sandra endlessly recounted the exploits of the next-door neighbours, two gay black men who were, outrageously, going through the process of adopting a baby.
"I've heard they might get a white one," she'd said in a hushed, horrified voice.
It was beautiful there, though. The rugged coast and sandy beaches a short stroll away. One of my favourite memories was a time when Laura ran shrieking along the beach, listing at the top of her voice all the things her mum was appalled by. The gays, the blacks, the Arabs, single mums, the state of the NHS, the Guardian, trade unions, Russell Brand, next door's cat, the cost of parking in town. Afterwards she had flopped exhausted on the sand and yelled, "Fuck you, mother!" much to the amusement of a passing surfer. I felt like saying fuck you to Sandra right now, and I guess it would have been easy to vent my frustrations on this aggravating woman and her husband. Instead I said, "So how long are you staying?"
"We have to get back today. Cassie," that was their dog, a cocker spaniel, "is with the neighbours."
"Not the gay black neighbours," I gasped.
"Peter and Lawrence, yes. They're very nice, actually, even though they are..."
She trailed off, looking around, suddenly aware that many of the nurses and other patients were black. "We're not in Cornwall any more, Toto," I muttered under my breath.
"Laura understands we must get back, don't you, Poppet?" Frank said.
His daughter nodded, staring towards her knees beneath the sheet.
"Laura's friend Erin, the unmarried pregnant one, was here earlier," Sandra said. "She asked if Laura could come and stay at ours for a while," she tutted.
"Can't she?" I asked.
"No, it's impossible. We've got the builders in at the moment, and I'm so busy."
"With what? Bitching about the neighbours and counting your money?" I wanted to ask.
"Laura will be fine with Erin. She seems like a decent young woman, I suppose."
"But she's about to have a baby," I said.
Maybe Laura could stay with you, then. Sandra clucked her tongue. I don't know why you two ever split up. Weren't you supposed to be getting married? Young people today don't stick at anything. The first sign of a bump in the road and they abandon ship.
I think that's a mixed metaphor, my sweet.
Oh, shut up, Frank.
I was still concentrating on the first thing she'd said, about Laura coming to stay with me. What was I supposed to say? It was what I wanted more than anything, not for her to come and stay with me, but to come back, to move in again. I glanced at Laura, whose eyes remained fixed on the bedsheet. Suddenly she looked up at us.
"I want you to go," she said.
I was about to smirk at Sandra and Frank when Laura added,
"All of you."
"Pop it," said Frank. "We just got here." "We haven't had a chance to talk some sense into you yet," said Sandra.
Laura picked up the bunch of tulips I'd laid on her bedside table and chucked it at her mother. As Sandra groped for something to say, Laura picked up an empty water glass and pulled her arm back. I grabbed her wrist to stop her from flinging it, too. Sandra and Frank stood there, mouths flapping.
"Go home,"
Laura said, apparently drained by the exertion.
"I don't need you, and you don't need to worry about paying for a funeral. I'm not going to kill myself."
Her voice grew even quieter.
"Not now."
Sandra and Frank exchanged a look and gathered their things. Unbelievable. They would rather take this excuse to make an exit than argue. Before they went, Sandra produced a paper bag and handed it to Laura.
"I brought you this. Thought it might help."
After they'd gone, Laura pushed the paper bag towards me, and I took out a paperback book. It was called Finding Your Happy Place, 21 Practical Ways to Beat Depression and Keep Smiling, and put it in the bin.
"Do you really want me to go too?"
I asked softly. She closed her eyes and nodded.
"I'm sorry, Danny, but I'm so tired. I didn't get much sleep."
"Okay," I hesitated.
"I'm so worried about you, Laura."
There was a long silence before she said,
"I'm not going to kill myself, okay?"
"Please don't. I couldn't bear to live in a world that you're not in."
A smile flickered.
"God, you're so corny sometimes."
"Are you still going to take the drugs you were prescribed?"
She cast her eyes downwards and shook her head. I stood there a moment longer, then said,
"All right, I'll come back later if that's okay. I've got a meeting with my therapist now anyway."
She nodded again, the blankness in her eyes creeping back.
"You should come with me to see her. She said it would help us, especially now," I was going to say, "now that you've tried to commit suicide. It wouldn't be like the therapist you saw when you were a kid, I promise."
"I'm fine," she said. "I'm feeling a lot better. I'll see you later, okay?"
I took the bus to Crouch End, sitting on the top deck. I could still feel the alcohol sloshing about in my system, and maybe it was this trace of drunkenness that made me feel a spark of optimism. Laura had called me Danny. She hadn't called me Danny since we'd split up. Maybe, I thought, her brush with death would make her decide we were better together, that she needed me. If she came back to me, if we were united again, I was convinced we would be able to recover from our experiences and fight anything else the world threw at us. We were 100 times stronger together. In the days and weeks following our return to England, when everything at home had seemed so dismal, the two of us trapped in our own dark spaces inside our heads, barely communicating, I had lost sight of that. Laura had taken it further. She said that looking at me reminded her of what had happened, that every time she saw my face, she was jolted back in time. She could never hope to recover when she saw me every day.
"But do you still love me?" I had asked, in one of the final days before she left.
There had been a long silence.
"Do you still love me?"
She looked at me searchingly, and maybe I took a moment too long to say, "Of course, always." I should have done everything I could to make her stay, to make it work. I should have convinced her that we were better together, that we could get through it if we were united. Instead, I had watched her walk out the door, barely protesting. Now I allowed myself to hope, and as the bus rattled along the street, I tried to work out how best to play it.
I decided I needed to give her time and space. I mustn't pressure her. But if I could persuade her to come and see Dr. Sauvage, either with me or on her own. I resolved to talk to Erin about it. Perhaps Laura would finally listen to her, now that Erin had saved her life. Dr. Sauvage's house was a few streets from the bus stop. The brightness had faded, and the sky above the terraced houses was colourless, like a picture in which the artist had forgotten to paint the sky. A child on a micro-scooter almost collided with me as I turned the corner onto Dr. Sauvage's street, making my heart jump. As I approached her house, which was halfway along, it gradually dawned on me that something was wrong. At first, I thought the house looked a little strange, darker than usual, with someone in a yellow coat standing outside. As I got closer, my mouth fell open. A dark grey blemish stretched across the facade of the house from the top windows, which had been boarded up down to the front door. The windows on the ground floor were cracked and coated with some kind of black substance. A broken chair lay in the front garden, and tiles had fallen from the roof. Yellow tape was strung around the whole house. The person in the yellow coat was a police officer, standing guard in a waterproof jacket. He looked up as I approached. "What happened?"
"Can I ask who you are, sir?"
"I'm one of Claudia Sauvage's patients. I have an appointment now." The policeman, who was younger than me and looked cold and miserable, said,
"I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but there was a fire here yesterday."
He cleared his throat.
"Oh, my God!" I forced out the words. "What caused it?"
The policeman looked up and down the street.
"I'm very sorry, sir, but I can't discuss that."
"Terrible business."
I whirled round. An elderly man had strolled across the road and stood looking up at the house, shaking his head.
"I live across the street," he said.
"Can't believe it.
That poor couple. They'll be missed dreadfully."
I took a moment for this to register.
"Missed?" I said quietly.
The old man stared up at the burnt-out house.
"Yes. Both the Sauvages are dead. They were trapped upstairs. Nothing the fire brigade could do."
He walked away, muttering,
"Terrible business. Terrible."
Chapter 24. I stopped off at my flat, grabbed my laptop and went out. I didn't want to be on my own at home. I needed to be around people, around the living. There was a coffee shop at the end of the road that also served greasy all-day breakfasts, just what my body craved. The first item on my list was to look up more information about what had happened to Dr. Sauvage and her husband. My relationship with my therapist had been purely professional, but that didn't make her death any less shocking. She was only in her 40s, and what a horrific and terrifying way to die. I wondered if her dogs, those snuffling pugs, had perished too. The story was on the Evening Standard website, with a photo of the burnt-out house, plus a snapshot of the smiling Sauvages, Claudia and Patrick, taken a few years ago. They had no children, which was something. There was no mention of the dogs. Then I read the line at the end of the article. "Police are trying to ascertain whether the Sauvages were victims of arson, and are expected to release more information in the coming days."
Arson? My God! Why would someone do that?
I wondered if Dr. Sauvage had made enemies. It was truly dreadful. And feeling guilty for the selfish thought, I wondered who I was going to talk to now. Laura was too fragile and my therapist was gone. That only left one candidate, my best friend. Jake and I arranged to meet the next day at Friend's House, the Quaker place on Euston Road. He had a meeting at the offices of a record company, who were based in a glittering new office block beside the station.
"This is it," he told me on the phone. "I'm pretty certain they're going to offer me a deal."
"That's amazing."
As soon as he gave me this news, I almost cancelled. He was so excited, I didn't want to bring him down. But I suspected that the moment he agreed to the deal, he would go into orbit for a while. It was best to talk to him now, while he was still within Earth's gravitational field. My CCTV equipment had arrived at lunchtime, and I'd spent the early afternoon setting it up. The camera was positioned above the entrance to the front door of the flat. It was connected to an app on my phone, and was triggered by movement.
If anyone entered the flat, the camera would start recording. As I left the flat, I looked up at the camera and smiled. Friend's house is at the Quaker's London base, with a cafe and meeting area that is open to the public. It was one of Jake's favourite places to meet, because of the relaxed vibe. I arrived first, bought a coffee and carrot cake, and took them to the back of the meeting area, where it was quiet and secluded. A few brave souls shivered outside in the courtyard, where a light dusting of snow that had fallen during the afternoon coated the tables and gathered on windowsills. While I waited, I texted Laura and asked how she was. I hesitated, then sent another message before she replied, telling her I was going to talk to Jake about what happened. "My therapist is dead," I typed, "and I need to talk to someone. I hope you understand. X." Jake arrived, wrapped in a chunky military-style coat, a long scarf wrapped around his neck. I had been right about him being ready for liftoff. Energy radiated off him as if he was a human microwave. He could barely keep still. He grabbed a large coffee and chatted up the Quaker girl at the counter. "Got a number," he grinned when he got back to the table. He sat down, his leg jerking back and forth, the worst case of restless leg syndrome I'd ever seen. "Hey, who was that Eastern European girl you were with the other night? She was well rude. Hot, though. Don't tell me you pulled her." "She wasn't that rude to you." He waved a hand. "Sorry, I'm turning into an egomaniac, aren't I? I need you to tell me when I'm acting like a wanker, Dan."
"Keep you grounded, you mean? Down here where the mortals live?"
"Hey, you're a supersonic business dude. Apps sell a lot more than music these days. It should be me keeping you grounded. Instead, you're still acting like the world is a funeral procession. Even though you're pulling hot women like that. Where was she from?"
"Romania," I said. He slapped the table.
"Really? So is she your new girlfriend? Have you given up on Laura? That would break my heart. I'm still convinced the two of you are going to get back together at any moment. Remember, you promised me I could be your best man. I've already got some great jokes lined up."
I sipped my coffee. It had gone cold. I was tempted to ask Jake to hold the mug, thinking that the heat coming off him would make it drinkable again. "No, she's not my girlfriend. But Romania, well, that's what I want to talk to you about." He sat forward.
"Surely you're not finally going to tell me what went down with you and Laura in Europe."
"I don't know, but I want to tell you about everything that's happened since." His phone rang.
"Sorry," he said. "Got to answer this."
He wandered out into the frosty courtyard, and I watched him talking animatedly. I was envious of him. Everything was going brilliantly, nothing tainted, no shadows clawing at the edges of his life. This moment, about to sign a record deal with everything ahead of him, the promise of greatness, was probably as good as it would ever get. As he had said, I should be feeling like that too, had indeed felt like it when Laura and I set off on our trip. I wished I was back in that place, the magical garden where Jake stood now. Seeing him striding about the courtyard, chatting away, a big smile on his handsome face, I realized that I couldn't be envious of him. He'd worked so hard for this. I was proud of him. He came back inside, his hair glistening with snowflakes.
"That was my manager. Universal and Sony want to meet me now, too. So that's three of the big four."
He rubbed his hands together.
"You deserve it," I said. "Thanks, man. Although I haven't signed anything yet."
"You will. You're going to be a star. Soon the only glimpse of you I'll get will be when you're in the paper, hanging out with Taylor Swift and Rihanna."
I think I'd prefer Beyoncé. Anyway, you're going to be a big techie superstar. We'll be going to the same parties. We'll be..." "Shit. Dan, your face. You look like I just reminded you that you've got cancer or something. I'm sorry. You have my undivided attention."
"Thanks."
"Come on, then. Hit me with it. What's going on?"
So I told him about the burglar returning my stuff and the fraudulent use of my debit card. I told him how my therapist's house had burned down, leaving me halfway through my course of treatment with no one to talk to. I filled him in on the details of Laura's suicide attempt, which made his mouth drop open, and how she'd apparently been seeing ghosts again. "I'm sure I saw someone watching her, too. And someone might have tried to push her under a tube train. All this weird shit."
"Fucking hell," he said when I'd finished. "Have you been to the police?"
They think I either hallucinated the break-in, that I'm crazy, or that I'm a liar and a time-waster. Sometimes I think I am going crazy. I trailed off. I decided not to tell him about hallucinating the photos from the train. It's ever since Romania. I looked at him, my eyes stinging. He didn't say anything for a few moments, just stared at me. And are you going to tell me what happened? I want to. I really need to talk to someone. That's what I intended to do, but now, when it comes to it... Daniel, it's me. You can talk to me about anything. I'm not going to go and blab to anyone about it, I promise. I know you think I'm a major gossip, but I swear, hand on heart, I won't tell, whatever it is.
I tore an empty sugar sachet to shreds, unable to meet his eye.
It's so hard to talk about. Just getting the words out. Plus, I'm afraid of burdening you with it. Burdening me? Come on. It can't be that bad.
I looked up at him. But it is. I started by telling him about the train journey, meeting Alina and Eon, the guards throwing us off, the creepy station in the middle of nowhere. He listened enrapt as I told him about the walk along the tracks, Alina going into the forest and disappearing, Laura and I going to look for her. And then we found a house, in the middle of the forest. He stared at me, eyes wide, as I told him what happened next.
Chapter 25. As we moved closer to the house, I could see grey shadows flickering in the upstairs windows, those jack-o'-lantern lights. Candles. Somebody was home. There was a little boy inside me, yelling at my adult self as we approached the place. This is a witch's house, a witch who lures and eats the lost, who'll fatten you and devour you, make bread from your bones. Run, run as fast and as far as you can, find a bed, get under the covers and hide there.
Laura touched my hand.
Daniel, look.
Laura was pointing at something, and at first I thought my heart had leapt from my body and was lying there, twitching in the dead grass. But I somehow got hold of myself, forced my eyes to focus.
Alina's other boot.
I stooped and picked it up, turned back to Laura, cradling the boot like it was a kitten.
We should go. Get help, I said.
My girlfriend set her jaw and, not answering me, walked up the path towards the house.
I wavered.
What was I? A boy or a man? Perhaps if I'd been here on my own I would have run, gone to seek help. But the need to stay with Laura, to not look like a coward, was even stronger. The door was solid, fashioned from the oak trees that surrounded the house. I could sense those trees behind us, like they were watching, daring us to go inside. All the hair on the back of my neck stood to attention. Ripples ran the length of my spine.
Why was this house here, deep in the forest?
I guessed it must have been the home of, what, a huntsman? A woodcutter? Some kind of ranger?
A witch?
The house had an ancient air about it, centuries old. It probably predated the railway line we had walked along. The door had no number, no letterbox. I suppressed a hysterical giggle at the thought of a postman traipsing through the forest to deliver junk mail and flyers from pizza places. Laura raised a fist to knock, but I caught her wrist. I somehow knew, as if I'd seen it in a dream, that the door would open if I pushed it. It did. It was stiff. Heavy, but it swung open slowly, revealing a large open space. I stepped inside, Laura following, holding onto my shirt. The room reminded me of the entrance hall of a stately home. It was dark, lit only by the moonlight that penetrated from outside. No candles here. I waited for my eyes to adjust and soon saw that the darkness concealed very little. A couple of chests, a coat stand with a black jacket hanging from it. Doors stood closed in both corners, and directly in front of us, a stairway stretched up into more darkness. Laura and I looked at each other. She looked more afraid now we were inside the house. If I had sensed a sickness about this place before we came inside, I felt it more keenly now. Terrible things had happened here. I knew that as clearly as I knew my own name.
Laura had taken a few steps into the room, but now moved back towards the exit, like she'd had second thoughts. Maybe it was the smell that did it. The room had a musty, damp odour, the cloying reek of mildew and rot. But there was another smell, a top note that was worse. Years ago I had lived in a bedsit that had a vile stink. Eventually I found the source. The previous tenant had left glue traps beneath the cooker and the fridge, and dead rats had been left rotting for weeks. That's what this place smelled like, rotting flesh, death. "You want to go?" I whispered to Laura. She stared at me, the fear evident in her eyes now. A look that said this was a mistake, a look that asked what the fuck we were doing here. The door had drifted shut behind us, and I had a horrible feeling that it was locked now, that we were trapped, that we would be trapped here forever. Maybe we would have gone then, done what we should have in the first place, gone back through the trees, kept going along the railway tracks, sought help in town. But then we heard the noise. Jake's mobile rang, jerking me back to the present moment. "Fuck, sorry," he said. "It's the guy from the record company." He clearly felt anxious about answering the call. "It's all right. Take it."
"I'm sorry, man. I'll be right back."
He stood up and walked away, saying, "Uh-huh, I'm right," as he went. I had torn a dozen more sugar sachets to shreds while talking, and now I picked at the pieces. Grains of white sugar were scattered across the tabletop. I felt sick, wondering if I'd have the guts to tell Jake the rest of the story, if I would be able to tell him the truth about what had happened. He reappeared at the table. He wore a sheepish expression.
"Daniel, man, I'm really sorry. They've moved the meeting forward, so the executive VP of A&R can sit in."
Seeing my blank expression, he added,
"He's like the top dog."
"You have to go."
"Daniel, I really want to hear the rest of what happened. Why don't we have a drink later, after my meeting?"
"Okay. Maybe." He bounced from foot to foot, agitated.
"Go on," I said, forcing a smile. "I'll call you later. Knock 'em dead."
"Thanks, Dan." He ran around the corner. I heard him bump into someone and apologize. Then he was gone. By the time I got back to my street, the sky was dark and starless, and the snow had given way to icy rain. Cold drops ran down the back of my neck as I entered my building and ran a hand through my hair. There was a new poster on the wall, the words printed by a trembling hand. "To whoever put their food waste in the green bin, this bin is for recycling only." This was followed by a threat to report this irresponsible person to the Residents Association. I rolled my eyes. I was surprised there was no mention of the pizza-munching fox. I trotted up the stairs and put my key in the lock, keen to get into the sanctuary of my flat, despite the recent intrusions. I felt jittery and uneasy in my skin, and had already decided that I didn't have the mental energy to meet up with Jake after his meeting and tell him the rest of the story. Another day. I flicked on the light. Nothing happened. The light in the communal hallway behind me was working, so it couldn't be a power cut. I left the heavy door propped open with my bag, which was just sturdy enough to hold it, and went into the kitchen to test the light there, flicking the switch. Again, nothing happened. The flat was in darkness. The fuse box was in a cupboard beneath the kitchen worktop, on the rare occasions when the power had gone out before. In fact, I could only remember it happening once. I had simply needed to push the fuse switch back down. Kneeling on the floor, trying to see the fuse box in the nearly non-existent light, I heard the front door shut, plunging me into complete darkness. Fuck, the bag must have been too light to hold the door for long, but I was able to feel the fuse switches now, running my finger along to find out which one had tripped. None of them had. I took my phone out of my pocket and used it as a torch to double-check. No, the fuse switches were all in position. Without removing the fuse cartridges, I couldn't see if the fuse wires were intact, and I couldn't remember whether the switch would trip if the fuse blew. In normal circumstances, none of this would have made me feel nervous, but recent events made me wonder. Had somebody been in here again? Had they disabled the lights? Were they still here, hiding?
I went back to the front door, feeling my way along the wall, stumbling over the vacuum cleaner and almost falling. I looked up at the CCTV camera above the door, wondering if it had captured anyone. Maybe someone had spotted it and turned the lights out so they could move about without being filmed. I fumbled for my phone so I could check the app that was connected to the camera and promptly dropped it. It bounced and skidded under the furniture. I hesitated. My fear that someone was in the flat now overrode my desire to find the phone, so I went back out into the communal hallway. The light, which switched itself off after a short while, had gone out now. I turned it back on and stood in the hallway, trying to decide what to do. I could knock on one of my neighbor's doors, ask them if they had a torch. I looked at my nearest neighbor's door. I never spoke to the woman who lived here, suspected that she was responsible for the crazy signs that were always appearing. I didn't want to get her involved, especially as the likelihood was that this was a failed fuse. I made a decision. I would go back in, recover my phone, and check the app to see if someone had been in the flat. I went back inside and, this time, used the vacuum cleaner to prop the door open. I got down on all fours and felt under the sofa and the coffee table, feeling for my phone. Where the hell was it? I swore out loud and thumped the floor with my fist. A scrabbling sound came from the bedroom. I jerked upright. There was someone in my bedroom. Oh, Jesus. I needed my phone. I needed to call the police. But then came another bang, then another. I jumped to my feet, headed to the front door, then thought, no. This was my chance to find out who had burgled my flat, to catch them and get some answers out of them myself. The police would probably take forever to get here, and I was pissed off, sick of my world being violated. I crept into the kitchen and took a large knife from the block on the worktop. Then, trembling with fear and fury, I tiptoed to the bedroom door and, holding the knife aloft with my right hand, used the left to quickly push the door open. For a moment I could see nothing, and then something hit me, knocking the breath from my body as I fell to the floor, forcing the knife from my grasp. It spun away across the carpet. Chapter 26. I was pinned to the floor on my back, foul, meaty breath in my face. A growl came from deep inside my attacker's body, and I pushed as hard as I could. But my attacker was on top of me, a blur in the darkness. Teeth and saliva and wet lips grazed my throat, and as adrenaline surged into my system, I found strength I didn't know I had, shoving and twisting onto my side. A second later, and the dog, the black dog that had leapt out of the darkness, would have torn out my throat. As soon as I twisted onto my side, I saw the knife just within reach. I grabbed it and swung it at the dog, which wriggled away as I tried to slash it. Instead, the blade nicked the side of its nose, and it let out a whimper of pain. As quickly as it had leapt onto me, it bounded away. I was free. It shot out through the front door, growling and barking, as I pushed myself up, coughing and feeling my neck. Just stinking saliva, no blood. If I hadn't been able to twist away, if I hadn't been carrying the knife, I didn't want to think about it. The dog had a Rottweiler's face, but was completely black and the size of a pit bull. A dog bred to guard, to fight, to kill. I staggered to my feet and went out into the hallway. The dog had run down the stairs and was dashing to and fro in the lower hallway, frantic, thumping into the door, bouncing off the walls. I stood at the top of the stairs, looking over the handrail, so I had a full view of the hallway, coiled and ready to rush back into my flat if the animal showed any sign of coming back up the stairs. At that moment, the door of my downstairs neighbor opened, and she appeared in the doorway. She was in her 30s, frizzy hair, glasses, wearing a thick pink jumper. She pointed a finger at me. "Hey, you're not allowed dogs in this building." The dog leapt towards her. She screamed and slammed the door shut with surprising reaction speed. The animal hit the wood mid-jump, crashed and fell to the floor, stunned for a moment, before getting back on its feet. It turned to look up at me, baring two rows of teeth like knives. I dashed back into my flat, shutting the door, plunged into darkness again. Once more I crawled across the living room floor, and my hand made contact almost immediately with my phone. I said a silent prayer and hit 999, listening as the dog rushed around downstairs,
emitting a series of harsh, low barks. The police came and summoned a dog warden, who captured the animal using a loop on a stick and dragged it into the back of his van. After he'd taken it away, the young police officer helped me examine the fuse box, finding that two of the fuse wires needed replacing. Fortunately, one of my neighbours, most of whom had come out to see what was going on, had some spares, so my lights were soon working again. "Bad luck for two to blow at once," the officer said. His name was Sadler.
"So, sir, what happened?"
I hesitated, on impulse, perhaps because I didn't want him to start looking at me in the way PC Sergeant had. I said, "I don't know. It must have followed me in when I got home, snuck in through the door behind me. When I found the lights weren't working, I left my flat door open, and it came in and attacked me."
He tutted. "Lots of strays around here. Most of them come from the estate." He shook his head at the state of the city he policed. "Do you need a doctor?"
"No, I'm fine. It didn't bite me. I'm just a bit shocked."
"Understandable, sir," he smiled. "You don't have any sausages in your bag, do you?"
I had temporarily lost my sense of humour. He said goodbye and went off to take a statement from the woman downstairs. After taking a moment to gather myself, I stood up, my legs unsteady, and went into the bedroom. It looked like a tornado had ripped through it. The bedside lamp lay broken on the floor, along with books, papers, and framed photographs of Laura and me. The bedding was trampled, and one pillow had been chewed, pieces of foam scattered around. I wondered why I hadn't heard it as soon as I came in, and guessed it must have fallen asleep after destroying my room and been awakened by the sound of my punching the floor. There was a terrible stench in the air, the source of which I found quickly. A huge turd curled on the little rug in front of the chest of drawers. I rolled the rug up and stuffed it into a black bin liner, taking it and dumping it in the bin outside. I sensed a presence nearby, and looked up to see the scavenging fox standing nearby. It turned and slunk away, tail dragging on the pavement. Needing to calm my jangling nerves, I poured a shot of vodka and walked over to look out at the dark, empty street. Icy rain streaked the glass. I wondered what had happened to the dog. Would it be put down, or would they attempt to rehome it? I waited until the warm bloom of the alcohol had slowed my heartbeat, quelled the tremor in my hands, then took out my phone and opened the app that had come with the camera. Immediately I could see that a video file had been created and stored on the cloud. A camera had captured whoever had come into my flat. The room was silent, and I found myself holding my breath, aware of my pulse thrumming in my ears. The video started to play. Because the camera was triggered by motion, as soon as the video started, I found myself looking at the top of someone's head and shoulders. They stood a few feet in front of my front door. The image was grainy and slightly blurred, presumably because it wasn't very well lit, but there was still natural light in the room. It got dark about 4:30 p.m. That meant they must have been in here late afternoon, probably while I was with Jake. I willed the person to step further into the room so I could see them better. All I could make out at the moment was that they were wearing a black top and a hat. I assumed it was a man. He took a couple of steps forward into my living room, the room where I sat now, so that he was visible down to his waist, and then turned around, and I leaned forward eagerly. At the exact moment that he turned, somebody else walked into shot, obscuring his face. There were two of them, and as they both walked further into the living room, I saw that the second person had the black dog who'd tried to kill me on a short leash. The second person was also wearing a hat. The two of them stood still, apparently looking around. Though, maddeningly, I could only see the backs of their heads. I could see their bodies now, though. They were both dressed in black long-sleeved tops and black trousers. But as I squinted at the screen, at the shape of their bodies, I suddenly realized I had been wrong to assume their gender. One of them, the one holding the dog, was a woman. And as they turned to talk to each other, I saw that they were wearing masks, those plastic masks that you attach to your head with a piece of elastic. But both masks were blank, plain white, with two eye holes and a small circle to breathe through. Looking at the blank masks sent a shudder through me. It was like looking at two phantoms, faceless creatures who had invaded my home. The woman yanked at the dog's leash and her mask slipped a little, Frustratingly, she caught it and pushed it back into place. Then she walked out of shot towards my bedroom with the dog. While she did this, the man walked around the room, opening drawers and cupboards, carefully shutting them again. After a while, the woman came back with the dog and shook her head. I wished I'd bought a camera with an audio recorder, as they had another conversation. The man gesticulated angrily, pointed at the dog and then towards my bedroom. The woman nodded. Then the man went over to the kitchen, disappearing from sight. The woman was facing the camera, so I had a perfect view of her. She was slim, with small breasts and narrow hips. The dog pulled at the lead, and she jerked it back, causing it to jump up onto its hind legs. Poor thing. Whoever she was strong. The man returned, and they both walked out of shot towards my bedroom. And that was it. The video captured another minute of still life, and then ended. They had come in, cut the fuse wire, presumably so when I arrived home in the dark, it would be harder for me to avoid the dog attack, then shut the animal in my bedroom, leaving just before it got dark. I shut the laptop and stared at the space where they had stood. I could feel their presence imprinted on the air. Chapter 27 It was unusually quiet on the South Bank, the bad weather keeping the day-trippers away. There were just a few Londoners scurrying beneath the snow-pregnant sky, hurrying to their homes and offices. The London Eye seemed to be turning more slowly this afternoon. The boats that drifted by on the grey, churning Thames looked like they should be carrying the dead across the Styx. I browsed around Foyle's for a while, then grabbed a coffee from Starbucks and took it to a bench that overlooked the river and the grand buildings on the embankment opposite. I checked my watch. She should be here soon. I felt strangely nervous, as if we were meeting for a first date, which was ridiculous. We knew each other intimately, inside and out. At least, I'd thought I'd known everything about her. Recently she had been a different person, an alien that had wrapped itself in Laura's body, only occasionally showing me a glimpse of the person she used to be. But Jake said I was like that, too. I hadn't contacted him since the previous afternoon, when he'd had to rush off. I resolved to call him later. I needed to tell him the rest of the story.
"Daniel."
I turned around.
"You came."
"Of course." Laura looked thinner and paler than ever, even more so than when I'd seen her in the hospital. She had her black coat wrapped around her, a coat which used to fit her perfectly, hugging the contours of her body, but which now seemed two sizes too big. She was wearing a woolen hat, too, and makeup, a little mascara and a dash of pink lipstick. It was the first time I'd seen her wearing makeup in ages. She sat down beside me and clasped her gloved hands together. Her knees bounced up and down. She smiled, but it slipped from her face almost immediately.
"You look better," I said.
She raised an eyebrow.
"No, really. It was so horrible seeing you in that hospital bed."
"It wasn't much fun being there." Her knees continued to bounce up and down. "I do feel better now, though. Much better. My skin's grown back."
"Huh?"
"But it's different. New skin."
I stared at her. "Laura, I have no idea what you're talking about. Did you get my message yesterday morning?"
She stared at me, her eyes wide and blank. Her voice dropped to a whisper, just audible above the wind that whipped across the Thames.
"Message?"
Before I could say anything, she said,
"I've got some news for you. I've quit my job."
"Oh, Laura! But you loved that job. You always said it was your calling."
"It was."
She stared out at the river.
"But not now. I just can't do it anymore. I could try, but I'd be letting everyone down. Letting the children down, the ones I'm supposed to help."
"I'm sure you wouldn't let anyone down." I touched her arm lightly. "But maybe it is for the best. You need to get well, and then I'm sure you could go back to it. Although," I swallowed, "you won't be here any more, will you? You'll be in Australia." She hugged her knees, which at least stopped them from bouncing.
"I'm not going."
I hardly dared speak, in case I'd misheard.
"Say that again." "I've decided not to go. I'm going to stay in London."
"Oh, that's amazing." I moved to hug her, but she shrank away. I gathered myself.
"What made you change your mind?"
She opened her mouth to reply, then stopped. I could see that she was trying to decide how much to tell me.
Like you said, it would be running away. I don't want to run any more. I don't want to be a coward.